the lead up to the Civil War, Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, was a harbinger for the arguments and violence that would soon define the country. Such was the case in 1838 when a spat over honor and a rumored bribe would divide Washington not just into Whigs and Democrats or Northerners and Southerners, but on whether and how duels should be conducted in our nation's capital. This is the story of the 1838 Silly Graves Duel, the first fatal congressional duel in U.S. history.
She's Sarah.
She's Harley.
And we're gaveling in another session of Crime in Congress.
The art of dueling, as practiced in America well into the 19th century, has its roots in Renaissance Italy, though notably the idea of trial by combat, as the practice was then called, dates back at least as far as Germanic tribal law. An early medieval law code dated from 1712 to 1730 AD referenced the practice as a means of settling land disputes between families. The Italians, I'm quoting an article by Joseph Farrell in the magazine of the National Endowment of the Humanities, associated honor, the basis for dueling, with dignity in the public sphere and self-esteem in the private realm. For men, this was often found through glory, respect, prestige, and honesty. For women, this was found through celibacy and fidelity. Like most of colonial American culture, dueling was imported from Great Britain, which had the concept of a judicial duel as early as the 11th century. The practice was formally outlawed by Parliament in 1819, but fell out of vogue much earlier than that. But that's not to say that duels were completely a thing of the past. England's last recorded duel took place in 1852 between two Frenchmen who were arguing over comments that, and I'm going to do my best with these French names, Frederick Constant Cornet allegedly made about Emmanuel Bartholomew's girlfriend. Because the practice was illegal, the surviving man, Bartholomew, was tried for murder. The first duel on American soil was recorded in 1612, only a year after the Pilgrims arrived at Plymouth. It was between Edward Doty and Edward Leicester, who, interestingly, were servants. Typically, duels were fought between gentlemen, aka upper classes. And both Edwards survived the sword fight with minor wounds. While the practice had already begun its decline in America at the time of the Civil War, it was practically abandoned by the 1880s. Though, because there's no federal law banning duels, the right to trial by combat has been floated in courts since, citing it as a common law right.
When you told me that we are going to be discussing duels, I remembered this story back from 2020 that I knew I had to bring up because it's just like so wild. I don't know if you remember it, but this 40-year-old man in Kansas asked a judge if he could settle his custody battle with his ex-wife with a trial by combat using Japanese swords. Naturally, he underwent a psychological evaluation and was found sane, meaning that he was fully consenting to fighting his ex-wife, presumably even to the point of death, with a Japanese sword.
Can you imagine being the lawyer having to argue for that? His entire defense must have been, my client is such a good father that he will prove it by sword fighting the child's mother?
Well, don't worry, that wasn't a problem because he was representing himself.
Okay, yeah, I should have guessed that.
Wait, before we move on, are there any states where dueling is still legal?
No. Every U.S. state has criminalized dueling. However, there are two states, Washington and Texas, where some forms of mutual combat are still legal. In Washington, to be legal, a fight has to be overseen by a police officer. Texas also requires a police officer to oversee the fight, and the fight becomes illegal if serious injuries are sustained or bystanders are hurt.
Interesting. Well, how do duels work exactly?
If we had the rights to the Hamilton soundtrack, this is the part where we would be taking an intermission to listen to 10 Duel Commandments. To those streaming, if you're a musical-loving crime-stituent, feel free to pause. We'll wait for you. I'll go into more detail as we discuss this specific duel. But in general, if two gentlemen could not settle a debate through compromise, the injured party would submit a written challenge to duel. Every duel was governed by the Code Duello, or Honor Code. Both parties would select seconds, whose job it was to resolve the conflict without violence. Should the duel continue, both parties will have the opportunity to shoot at each other, and a series of shooting, and negotiating continues until a compromise is reached, both parties agree that their honor has been sufficiently defended, someone surrenders, or someone is seriously injured or dies. In researching this case, or I guess duel, I read the book Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War by Joanne Freeman. It's based on the writings of Benjamin Brown French from New Hampshire, who served as House Clerk beginning in 1833. His position as a well-liked, intelligent man with respect from all sides of the aisle, in addition to him quite literally being a professional Congress watcher, made him a unique voice that gave previously unheard-of accounts of floor proceedings. This is a fascinating book that I'm going to use for multiple episodes because it details dozens of incidents of violence on the House and Senate floors and between members near or around the Capitol leading up to the Civil War. Duels in Congress at this time were about two often intertwined things, honor and slavery. The issue of preserving slavery was a particular trigger for many, especially Southern Democrats, and led to the uptick in violence that would hit a fever pitch at the start of the Civil War in 1861. Freeman notes that a nation divided enough to fight itself in war had to be influenced, at least in part, by its leaders, who signaled time and again that violence was the appropriate, gentlemanly way to resolve conflict. But the rules and norms governing duels differed greatly between the North and the South. Quoting Field of Blood, "Southern violence in its notorious brutality was meant to impress. Honor culture was a piece of this world. A man was only as honorable as others thought him to be. Duels were more about parading manhood and showing coolness under fire than they were about killing. Cower before a duel challenge, and you were no man at all." Northern violence was different. This isn't to say that Northerners couldn't be savagely violent or that they were immune to the power of honor culture. The Yankee Code of Honor, as the French called it, had its own logic and power. Less grounded in gunplay, it was no less centered on manhood. Yet as belligerent as Northerners could be, many were slower to fight than Southerners and quicker to call in the law. In total, Freeman found 70 different instances of duels involving a sitting member of Congress. In the words of Lin-Manuel Miranda, I couldn't help myself, "Most disputes die and no one shoots," became a comfort blanket for Washington politicians, many of whom believed in the power of duels to quell emotions. By dictating timelines and procedures for responding to anger, the idea was that people would make better, less emotional decisions and violence overall would decrease. To quote Senator William Campbell Preston, "The law cannot restrain slander, a pistol sometimes will." That comfort blanket, at least among the upper echelons of Washington, D.C., would be torn to shreds in February 1838. Let's set the scene. It's another normal day in Washington where 242 representatives from all 26 states were crammed onto the old House floor, convening another session of the 25th Congress. Since the time Congress moved into the Capitol building in 1800, the legislature had more than doubled in size, and I have to imagine the physical closeness of all of these members contributed to their propensity for violence.
Yes, and the lack of AC, I also presume.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking through a fog of smoke, smoking and chewing tobacco were practically congressional procedure. Representative Henry Wise, a Whig from Virginia, whose own reputation for violence and just being a pain to work with warrants its own episode, rose to speak. "Mr. Speaker, I have a subject of the deepest importance to bring to the attention of this House, a subject which involves the honor and purity of Congress, and the purity of the whole government. Sir, I bring to the attention of the House a direct and unequivocal charge against a member of the Congress of the United States of corruption, a charge which is openly made by the editors of two responsible papers in this country, who can vouch that the charge can be proved by a responsible witness or witnesses." He then proceeded to read the article in the New York Courier and Inquirer, alleging the corruption of an unnamed member of Congress. The source was anonymous too, going by Spy in Washington. Luckily, because Rep. Wise read the article, it was entered into the Congressional Record, which at this time was the Congressional Globe. I have a copy of it here. Sarah, can you read it for us?
Oh, absolutely. "Corruption in Congress. We yesterday published a letter from the Spy in Washington directly charging a member of Congress with corruption and offering to prove the charge before a committee of either House when called upon for that purpose. We republish that charge today and call upon Congress to promptly initiate the investigation thus challenged, both as an act of justice to itself and to the country." He then goes on to quote the letter itself, with the key lines reading, there is at least one member of Congress who has offered to barter his services and his influence with the department or departments for compensation. He, being an unnamed member of Congress accused of bribery, is quoted as saying, "Why? Things do not go here by merit, but by pulling on the right strings. Make it my interest, and I will pull the strings for you." So do we have any idea who this guy is, or if any of this is even true?
We do, actually, but I'm going to hold on to that tidbit for a little longer because accusations would almost immediately start playing out on the House floor. After Rep. Wise called for a select committee to investigate the charges, they were debating a resolution that would have created that select committee. Rep. Silly, a Maine Democrat, rose in opposition. He said that a select committee would be, quote, novel and extraordinary, and urged the House to slow down. He continued, saying, quote, "This charge comes from an editor of a newspaper, and we all know that in a country where press is free, few men can expect to escape abuse and charges of a similar description." He trusted the House wouldn't go into an investigation of this kind on a mere newspaper statement, without proof. His point essentially was that unless the spy in Washington was willing to name names under oath, Congress should not take the claim seriously. As a side note here, at this time there was no transcription of House floor proceedings. They were summarized and then written down. So sometimes quotes will say he, sometimes they'll say I. That just has to do with how they were taking notes at the time.
Got it. I have to say, waiting to act until you know more seems like a very reasonable stance to me.
Well, there were several congressmen who would disagree with you. In short, the Whigs were in favor of an investigation, which made sense given that it was published in a Whig newspaper. And the Democrats did not. Rep. Jonathan Silly, a Maine Democrat, quipped during his remarks, "If this is the same man," referring to James Watson Webb, the paper's editor, "who attacked the Bank of the United States in his paper and then changed his tune after it granted him a loan, he didn't deserve much credit in Congress." It would soon emerge during debate that the accused was among the friends of this administration. In case you're not a history buff, I'm honestly not either, 1838 was during the Martin Van Buren administration, and Van Buren, like his predecessor Andrew Jackson, was a Democrat. Van Buren served as both Secretary of State and Vice President during the Jackson administration.
Honestly, these sounds like the debates that we could be having on the House floor today. Whether or how seriously to take unsubstantiated, likely partisan accusations of corruption, and the correct use of congressional oversight powers.
I was struck by that too. It really felt like a debate on misinformation, which we've seen play out a ton over the past few years. As debate drew on, it got more heated. But things shifted when Wise insinuated that Silly could be the anonymous member of Congress mentioned in the Inquirer. "Mr. Wise, the name of the person implicated is not given there, but he wished to be permitted to say to the gentleman from Maine," being Mr. Silly, "that the gentleman was much more likely to be met than him," said Mr. Wise. "I have no influence with the executive departments to sell, none whatever. I can go home to my constituents free from any such suspicion. Who is it that has influence to sell? It is those who belong to that party which the gentleman from Maine acts. He hoped the charge might prove to be untrue, but he hoped there was not one other gentleman of that party who, in all probability, was implicated, that would hesitate about making this inquiry. The editor of the paper was responsible for the charge he has made, and although the letter to which the editor referred was anonymous, still it was over the signature of the spy in Washington, and that letter writer is well known here as the editor of the Courier and Inquirer."
So Mr. Wise from Virginia insinuated that the reason Mr. Seeley was on the floor speaking out against the resolution was because he was guilty?
Precisely. And there were a lot of people during debate who were critical of that type of accusation, warning that it could discourage people from speaking out in the future. Freeman has a great description of what happened after Wise levied these attacks, so I'm going to let her take it from here. Quote, "When Seeley predictably bristled at hearing the basest charges insinuated against himself, Wise stopped him mid-sentence and played the honor card. Dramatically turning to face Silly, seated behind him, he asked if Silly had meant to accuse him of making base charges, aka false charges. This was moving into dual territory. Silly said that Wise had been ungenerous. Unsatisfied, Wise asked again, and Silly repeated himself. So Wise upped the stakes. Was Silly deliberately insulting him? An answer of yes would have justified a duel. No, Silly insisted, but he knew his rights and the rights of his constituents. He had every right to speak his mind. A little more taunting and sneering by Wise, and the moment had passed. This is a perfect example of why first-person accounts from this period of time are so important, which is what Field of Blood is based off. Because the Congressional Globe at the time summed up this entire exchange in three words. Some mutual explanations.
Okay, but certainly there were reporters there to witness this exchange, right? I mean, who is the 1830s Jake Sherman?
In this case, French is our Lady Whistledown, Gossip Girl, Olivia Beavers, whatever you want to call him. And to your point about reporters, yes, there was freedom of the press, and yes, there were often reporters who oversaw these scenes, but there wasn't much of an incentive to publish it. Not only did threats and violence practically run Washington, scaring many people away from pursuing negative stories, but the majority of papers were only able to survive through government printing contracts. That's why, even when these spats were covered, they were often downplayed. Wise knew what he was doing when he used the phrase base charges. He was appealing to the code of honor, acknowledging that Silly had accused him, Wise, of making false statements, thereby challenging his honor. Rule 4 of the Honor Code, which was drafted in 1777 to govern duels in England and Scotland, and was largely adopted in America, says, quote, "When the lie direct is the first offense, the aggressor must either beg pardon in express terms, exchange two shots previous to apology, or three shots followed up by explanation, or fire on till a severe hit be received by one party or the other."
I see. Can you translate that?
Yeah. So when Silly accused Wise of making false charges, after Wise insinuated that Silly could be the person the spy in Washington was referring to when he levied charges of corruption, he was insulting Wise's honor. In Wise's eyes, say that three times fast, Silly was calling him a liar. This was almost a written invitation for a duel. Dueling expert and swordsman Eric Raymond was quoted in Smithsonian Magazine as saying public insults, romantic clashes, political disputes, cheating at cards, all could be cause for an encounter. Classically, one of the likeliest ways to end up in a duel was to give the lie direct. That is, publicly accuse another gentleman of lying. Wise, who had a reputation for violence, knew that by invoking the Southern tradition of the Honor Code, he would force Silly to either A, challenge him to a duel, or B, sacrifice his, quote, manhood, which at this time was your reputation, therefore looking like a coward. Silly didn't take the bait, at least not yet, and almost immediately faced a public smear campaign. Just days after this encounter, the Baltimore Sun, which Silly did read, ran an article that said of the North and, by extension, Mr. Silly, quote, "Dueling is considered an irresponsible and irreligious pursuit, and the man who flogs his neighbor with anything larger or more violent than an ox gourd is set down for a rap rascal, and is voted out of church by the pious deacons and deaconesses. As Mr. Silly is a man of great practical and devotional piety, he may possible eschew the pistol and seize the ox gourd."
I have so many questions. A, what is an ox guard? Gourd? Guard? And why wasn't Wise smeared in the press for failing to defend his honor by issuing a duel of challenge?
I had to look this up myself. An ox gourd is a wooden tool, approximately 8 feet long, fitted with an iron spike or a point at one end, which was used to spur oxen as they pulled a plow or cart. By saying that Mr. Silly was more likely to use an ox gourd than a pistol, the writer was saying that Mr. Silly was undignified and not a gentleman. And because he came from a northern culture that looked down on duels, he was a coward too. Wise, on the other hand, was a southern gentleman who abided by the code and had already proven himself on several occasions. Under his breath, after the clash on the floor with Silly, he said, "But what's the use of bandying words with a man who won't hold himself personally accountable for his words?" Giving some further insight into why Wise didn't issue a duel challenge. He wasn't immune to criticism, though. French, the house clerk, would opine in his journal that Wise had let a gross insult pass and wondered if he was too cowardly to advance towards a duel. Essentially, it was a game of cat and mouse. Wise was the cat, Silly was the mouse. Wise had the power and reputation, Silly didn't. This put Silly in a very difficult position. On one hand, if he decided to ignore the personal attacks, he would be smeared as a coward and his reputation was on the line. If he took the bait and challenged a duel, he would risk angering his constituents, who viewed dueling as irresponsible, irreligious, barbaric, and unequivocally Southern. But an unexpected arrival in D.C. was about to shake things up even more, forcing Sibley to make a decision. Kind of. Like his fellow Whig Henry Wise, James Watson Webb, the editor of the Inquirer, which ran the Spy in Washington letter, was prone to violence. When Sibley questioned his integrity on the House floor, you'll remember he said, quote, "If this is the same man who attacked the Bank of the United States in his paper and then changed his tune after it granted him a loan, he didn't deserve much credit in Congress." Webb headed straight to Washington with violent intent. Freeman writes that Webb, though by no means a Southerner, the native New Yorker was a fighting man's fighting man. Over the course of his eventful career, he threatened, caned, horsewhipped, and dueled with his antagonists, and was himself threatened, beaten, and shot.
My God.
This wasn't the first time he'd hightailed it to Washington for a fight either. In 1830, he attacked the Washington Telegraph editor Duff Green for insulting him on the Capitol steps. Now, here's something I didn't know about duels until I was researching this case. Men are only required, per the honor code, to duel men who are on their social level. In Washington, members of Congress were considered gentlemen, and newspaper editors were not. So, despite Webb making the long trip to Washington, Sibley didn't have to duel him, and had no intention to. He even said as much, telling a duel advisor, "Webb has come here to challenge me because he, and perhaps others, think that, as I am from New England, I am to be bluffed. And Mr. Webb will then proclaim himself a brave man." Freeman put this in simpler terms. Fighting man Webb would promote himself by humiliating a non-combatant.
So let me make sure I have this straight. At this point, there are three men primarily involved: Wise, Sibley, and Webb. Sibley accused Wise of lying, which could be grounds for a duel. And then Webb accused Sibley of slander, also ground for a duel. But since they were on different social levels, Sibley wasn't obligated to participate. So this means that the only real threat of violence then is still between Wise and Sibley, with Webb just there, I guess, to stir the pot?
Yes. However, that dynamic is about to change again, because a fourth man, William Graves, a Whig from Kentucky, was about to enter the picture, and he would play a critical, if not the most critical, role in the events that followed. In keeping with the honor code, Webb did not approach Sibley himself with a challenge, which is a written invitation to duel. He instead recruited the help of his friend, William Graves, who himself admitted to not being very well versed in the rules and procedures of dueling. I have to believe that Webb did this on purpose. He knew Graves was inexperienced and capitalized on that to get what he wanted. If he had known how this would play out, he almost certainly would have rejected the offer. On Wednesday, February 21st, 1838, Webb pulled Graves, a Whig from Kentucky, to the edge of the House floor and asked him if he would deliver a letter to Sibley. "I paused," Graves would later say. "It instantly struck me that this paper was a challenge." Webb immediately assuaged his concerns, saying that it was a letter of inquiry. In keeping with the honor code, before a duel could be challenged to the offended party, Webb was required to give Sibley the opportunity to explain and apologize. If Graves had agreed to deliver a challenge for Webb, that would be a de facto agreement to act as Webb's second, meaning he would be responsible for fighting in Webb's place and negotiating peace. But if it's just a letter of inquiry, like Webb is claiming, then Graves wouldn't be agreeing to be Webb's second by merely transporting the letter. And to Webb's credit, it was a letter of inquiry. The last line of his letter read, "The object of this communication is to inquire of you whether I am the editor to whom you alluded, and, if so, to ask the explanation which the character of your remarks renders necessary."
So did this letter mention a duel, and did Graves read it?
No, a duel was never mentioned, and Graves did read it. However, and this is where someone who is more savvy with dueling codes would have the upper hand, this was the first step in moving towards a duel, and that certainly appeared to be Webb's intention. I don't think he trekked all the way to D.C. to hand someone a letter through a surrogate. Totally unconscious that any possible mischief could arise out of my carrying a simple paper of interrogation from one gentleman to another, he would later say, Graves agreed to deliver the letter of inquiry to his colleague, Sibley. Graves walked across the House floor, found his colleague Silly, and went to hand him the letter. But when Silly heard it was from Webb, he immediately refused to accept it, saying, quote, he didn't want to be drawn into personal difficulties with the conductors of public journals. Graves would make a second attempt to deliver the letter with the same outcome. This put the two men, neither of whom were close to duel experts, in uncharted territory. While Silly was well within his ability to snub a newspaper editor, the man delivering the letter to him, which he was convinced was a duel challenge, was his equal. Therefore, even though it was Webb's letter, Silly dishonored Graves by refusing to accept it. Freeman writes, they were fighting a party battle with a sectional weapon that could easily misfire in their hands. And misfire, I would argue, it did. The precariousness of the situation was not lost on either Graves or Silly. At this time, duels were community events, meaning there were multiple people, from advisors to seconds to doctors, involved. Recognizing that they may have unintentionally stumbled into a duel, the two men immediately started collecting advisors to help them determine their next moves. Fortunately, because of a congressional investigation, we have a transcript of what happened next, and I thought it would be fun if we did a little role play.
Yes, let's do.
Sarah, you'll be Silly and I'll be Graves. This is an abbreviated version of their conversation, and it was via letters over the course of a couple days, not in person. All right, so I'm reading for Graves. In the interview I had with you this morning, when you declined receiving from me the note of Colonel J.W. Webb, please say whether you did not remark, in substance, that in declining to receive the note, you hoped I would not consider it disrespectful to me, and that you did not rest your objection upon any personal objections to Colonel Webb as a gentleman.
I declined to receive the note because I chose to be drawn into no controversy with Mr. Webb. I neither affirmed nor denied anything in regard to his character. I stated to you, and now repeat, that I intended by refusal no disrespect to you.
Sir, your note of yesterday is inexplicit, unsatisfactory, and insufficient. I have, therefore, to inquire whether you declined to receive his communication on the ground of any personal exception to him as a gentleman or a man of honor. A categorical answer is expected.
I regret that mine of yesterday was unsatisfactory to you, and decline any further response to it.
As you have declined accepting a communication which I bore to you from Colonel Webb, I am left with no other alternative but to ask that satisfaction which is recognized among gentlemen. My friend, Honorable Henry A. Wise, is authorized by me to make the arrangements suitable to the occasion.
Your note of this morning has been received. My friend, General Jones, will make the arrangements suitable to the occasion. So did we just agree to dueling each other?
Technically, but we're not gentlemen, so we're good. What struck me about this exchange is that it seemed as though Graves was literally begging Silly to give him a reason to bow out of this conflict. They didn't want to fight each other. Graves didn't really even have anything to do with this. It all feels so avoidable.
Yeah, these letters are like a little testy, but like not to the point of potentially like killing each other.
I agree with you in my 2024 brain, but it was of the times and a duel between Graves and Silly was set for February 24th. Joining Graves on the battlefield were Henry Wise, his second, U.S. Navy Surgeon Jonathan M. Fultz, his doctor, Richard H. Menifee, Whig from Kentucky, a friend, and John H. Crittenden, another friend and Whig from Kentucky. Silly's team included George W. Jones, delegate from the Wisconsin Territory, his second, Alexander Duncan, his doctor, Jesse Bynum, a Democrat from North Carolina, as his friend, and Colonel James W. Schamburg, a Democrat from Louisiana. Kentucky Whigs John Calhoun and Richard Hawes would also join, bringing blankets, as they were convinced Graves would be shot. In his friend's words, Graves fired with an awkwardness very remarkable in one educated and residing in Kentucky. They even filed his trigger down to help prevent a misfire. Fortunately for Graves, Silly wasn't any better. He was a rifleman, but was nearsighted and hadn't shot a gun in years, prompting French to make the joke, Silly has been invited to stand up and be shot at. Needless to say, both men had a practice session before the big day. Despite doubts that the duel would even occur, given the pettiness of the issue they were fighting over and the fact that a northerner was involved. A little past noon on the 24th, after taking some time to secure rifles, 10 members of Congress crossed the Anacostia Bridge into Maryland. But, and you'll see human error pop up again and again throughout the day, no one knew where the D.C. border was, so they had to ask a random person where to go. After the carriages arrived at the field, the men got in position. Silly and Graves took their paces. You were supposed to stand 80 yards apart or 80 paces, but the men took very big steps and ended up being closer to 92 yards apart. And their second stood in the middle, off to the side and out of earshot of both Silly and Graves. Silly stood at an elevation and Graves was facing the sun. The seconds loaded the rifles and handed them to their duelers. As the winner of the coin toss, George Jones broke what must have been a thick silence. "Gentlemen, are you ready? Fire. 1, 2, 3, 4. Silly fired his gun before it was fully raised and misfired. Graves, shooting late, misfired. Round one was over. Taking a sigh of relief, the seconds convened. Wise, on behalf of Graves, spoke. "Cannot Mr. Silly make some disclaimer which will relieve Mr. Graves from his position?" Jones, on behalf of Silly, responded, reiterating that he had no disrespect for Graves, saying, quote, "because he entertained for him then, as he does now, the highest respect and the most kind feelings," but refused to back down. Wise, after conferring with Graves, said he stands, quote, "precisely in the position which he stood when the challenge was sent." After 20 minutes of negotiations, no peace could be met, and the men readied to shoot again. Jones' voice rang out. "Gentlemen, are you ready? Fire. 1, 2, 3, 4. Graves lifted his gun and misfired. Silly missed. Relieved once again, the seconds sought reconciliation. "Silly has proven himself a brave man," Jones said. "The matter should end here." "No," Wise said. "He would only accept two outcomes. Either Silly would claim privilege of debate, which was invoking Article 1, Section 6 of the U.S. Constitution, which, interestingly, gives members of Congress the right to not be questioned in any other place for things said on the House floor. Or Silly must state that Webb is a gentleman." Finding no resolution, the seconds reloaded the rifles and prepared for round three. "Gentlemen, are you ready? Fire. 1, 2, 3, 4. Both men raised their guns. They aimed, fired, and this time, Graves didn't miss. Silly dropped to the ground. "I am shot," he said, collapsing into Schomburg's arms. The ball severed Silly's abdominal aorta, killing him within minutes. A random tourist, who had always dreamed of witnessing a duel and just kind of tagged along, delivered the news to Graves and his team. Very bold. "He is dead, sir." Wise broke out in tears as Silly's men carried his body into a carriage and headed back to the district. Back in Washington, things were equally tense and chaotic. John Quincy Adams said, quote, "there was an agitation in the House, different from that which is occasioned by an irritated debate. A restless, uneasy, whispering disposition, clustering into little groups with inquisitive looks, listening ears, and varying reports as one member or another went out of or came into the hall." Hearing of the duel that morning, the district attorney was actually sent to arrest the men, but went to the wrong place. I'm not entirely sure what the grounds would have even been for this arrest, given that dueling was still legal, but it never amounted to anything. Webb tried to get in on the action too. He was not happy that Graves was taking his place in the duel, which is wild because literally no one, not Graves, not Webb, not Silly, not the larger Washington community, no one wanted this duel to happen. He gathered his friends, he being Webb, and guns, and went to Silly's boarding house with a plan and a threat. "Duel me, or I'll break your arm so you can't duel Graves."
Oh, so gentlemanly.
Right? Silly wasn't home when Webb arrived, so he had another plan. Race to the dueling ground and insist on taking Graves' place. He went all around D.C. looking for the duel. But after going to the wrong location three times, gave up and decided to just let the duel proceed as planned.
This guy is such a clown. Also, I used to wonder how people got around it all the time, like without a GPS, but after this story, I'm starting to think that they just didn't, and they were just okay with going to the wrong place.
It really sounds like it. Congressmen corralled around the carriages as they pulled into D.C., and news would spread quickly that Silly had been killed. His body lay in state at the Capitol Rotunda, and he was buried in the Congressional Cemetery. John Quincy Adams called it the funeral of a saint, with guests such as the president and vice president in attendance. Though, interestingly, the Supreme Court refused to attend the funeral of a duelist. Even after Silly was laid to rest, the anger and frustrations surrounding this death was not. Serious threats were made against Wise and Webb, with Freeman writing that handbills were handed out announcing that Wise and Webb were to be burned in effigy near City Hall. Webb for causing the tragedy, and Wise for pushing it to its violent close. Graves and Wise were also threatened with hanging. In response to these threats, Webb took a walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, begging people who had a grievance with him to fight. No one did, but there was a mocking political cartoon drama drawn up that I'll put in our Instagram for the session because it's great.
Oh, good.
Back home, both Wise and Graves had some explaining to do in what was one of the biggest political scandals of the moment, particularly in the North. Wise's written statement read, "Your representative is accountable to you for his personal as well as his political conduct, for by it he is worthy of you, or you are dishonored." His argument was basically that Silly died to defend the North's honor, and they should be grateful. Graves had a slightly easier path to forgiveness, given that his constituents had a more favorable view of dueling. But that's not to say it was all smooth sailing. In a speech, he told them that he felt the honor of his state in his hands and preserved your honor with my own, and was met with great applause. The partisan papers got in the mix as well, with a Democrat paper running the headline in all caps, "Bank ruffians hired to shoot down Democratic Republican members of Congress." Whig papers took a different approach, slamming the Democrats for using a bloody tragedy for electioneering purposes. On Wednesday, February 28th, 4 days after the fateful duel, Representative John Fairfield, a Democrat from Maine, called for an investigation into Silly's death. After intense debate, the final vote was 152-49 in favor of an investigation, with the vote falling not along partisan lines, but along sectional lines. All but one Northern representative supported an investigation.
What were the arguments for and against it?
Well, Whigs were threatening violence against anyone who served on the committee, which was certainly a factor. There was also debate over whether it was the proper role of Congress to get into what was technically a private matter. The committee consisted of 4 Democrats and 3 Whigs. Unsurprisingly, they were not able to come to a consensus about who was at fault and what the proper path forward was, so they produced 3 different reports, which is where I got a lot of the original quotes used in this episode. The majority report, signed by 3 Democrats and 1 Whig, found that Wise, Jones, and Graves were at fault. They recommended that Graves be expelled and Wise and Jones be censured. The second report, signed by 2 Whigs, made the argument that the committee had no right to do what it was doing, so it didn't take any sides or suggest any repercussions. A 3rd report, written by a singular Democrat, recommended that there only be mild punishments, as there was no precedent for punishing congressional duelers in the past. Though, as we've mentioned, there was also no precedent for members of Congress being killed in a duel, which seems relevant. Freeman summarized the reports as, quote, purely partisan and purely sectional.
Kinda sounds a lot like the messaging around the January 6th committee.
It really does. And the end result was similar as well. The reports were tabled and no one was punished. After these events, Northerners rallied together to fight for anti-dueling legislation. The bill called for 10 years hard labor if someone was killed in a duel, 5 years for dueling at all, even without a death, and 3 years for assaulting someone who refused a duel. Southerners sneered at these provisions, seeing it as protection for weak Northern congressmen. This made it a difficult vote even for some Northerners, who didn't want to seem like they were scared of Southern duel traditions. But opposing the law would mean supporting a practice that was losing popularity and just resulted in a highly avoidable death of their colleague. The bill passed, with 40% of its members not voting at all, which kind of shows you how politically poisonous this issue was. Though, ironically, the harsh measures in the bill, which only banned dueling in Washington, D.C., made it so that it was rarely enforced. The political fallout from the duel was minuscule. The only person who lost their seat after participating in the duel was Jones from Wisconsin. But before you feel bad for him, he would become an Iowa senator 10 years later. Freeman, who I just want to plug again because her book was pivotal for this episode, put it eloquently. Here, perhaps, is the most fundamental reason for congressional violence. When it came to earning influence in Congress and back home, it worked all too well.
I'm both like overwhelmed and underwhelmed by everything you just told us. Overwhelmed because it's insane that these like bumbling buffoons were seen as gentlemen and elected to Congress. And like this whole concept of honor and duels is just so warped, but also underwhelming because this is really no reason for them to be fighting at all. Wait, earlier you said that you knew who the accused congressman was in the Spy to Washington letter, which kicked this whole thing off. Who was it? Seeley?
After all of this, the fights, violence, slander, and investigations, the man the spy in Washington was alleging had accepted bribes was not anyone on the dueling ground that day. Instead, it was John Ruggles, a Maine Democrat, who was accused of accepting bribes for patent application approvals. However, it's important to note that these claims were never substantiated, and a congressional investigation recommended that all charges be dismissed, and on April 25th, 1838, they were.
Wow, there's like so much to unpack here. I know it can feel like Congress is an absolute mess right now, and it is, but this like really puts things in perspective to me a little bit. I mean, even now when we're dealing with like unprecedented event after unprecedented event, I'm thinking about Santos expulsion and the many censure resolutions that we've seen lately. No one's died, so that's a big distinction.
Yeah, and I can't get over how unnecessary this duel was. I know I've said it, but no one wanted this. This was a fight to the death over egos and nothing more. The only good thing to come out of this was the anti-dueling law.
And even that sounds like a small win because you said it was rarely enforced. Wow, I'm excited to hear more from this book.
I'm excited to share it with you because, truthfully, we're just scratching the surface of Congress's violent history. I had a hard time even, like, cutting some of the really interesting anecdotes for this episode, so maybe we'll have to have, like, an anecdotes episode where I just, like, tell you little tidbits that Freeman shares.
I love that.
But until then, Sarah, do you want to gavel us out?
Oh, yeah.